Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with some foreign policy issues that have been overshadowed by the economic hostage crisis on Capitol Hill. Ambassador Mark Ginsburg joins us to talk about Iran's role in shoring up the murderous Assad clan in Syria with both money and Iranian Revolutionary Guard thugs who have honed their skills beating, jailing, and murdering Iranian protesters during the Green Revolution. Then we will speak with an Israeli Air Force veteran, Brigadier General Nehemia Dagan, who is currently touring the United States, sponsored by J Street, the dovish alternative to AIPAC, promoting a two-state solution. We will discuss the absence of peace and even a peace process between the Israelis and Palestinians and what can be done to bring the parties back to the table. Then, given the high stakes in the current economic hostage crisis brought on by those who created the deficit that all except the wealthiest Americans are expected to pay down at the cost of killing economic recovery, we will get an update on the latest insanity on Capitol Hill. Thomas Ferguson, professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts and a member of the advisory board of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, joins us. I'm now joined by Ambassador Mark Ginsburg, who is a former presidential advisor and United States ambassador to Morocco. He served as a legislative assistant to Senator Edward Kennedy, special assistant to the Secretary of State, deputy senior advisor to the President for Middle East Policy, and senior U.S. coordinator for Mediterranean Trade, Investment, and Security Affairs. He serves as a special advisor to the Department of Defense Special Operations Command and an advisor to the United States Department of State on outreach initiatives to the Muslim world. He has an article out in the Huffington Post called Iran's Proxy War with Syria is Shoring Up Assad. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador Ginsburg.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
And Ambassador, you wrote about, of course, the revolutionary anthem in your Huffington Post piece, Iran's Proxy War with Syria Shoring Up Assad. You wrote about the revolutionary anthem, Come On, Bashar, Leave. Well, since you've written that, of course, the songwriter, his body was found floating in the river with his throat cut out.
Yes, indeed. Another example of the treachery and murderous mentality of the Assad regime against its own people.
And I understand that in many ways the key to stopping it, since Iran and Hezbollah are helping, would be if the Syrian army cracked up. And at this point, it looks like Maher Assad, the psychotic younger brother of Bashar al-Assad, he controls the Republican Guards and the 5th Division. And I understand the army is essentially locked down in its barracks, and it can't leave unless an Alawite officer basically approves it. So you have this Alawite clan controlling the military, but it's majority Sunni. Is there any evidence that you can see that the army will crack?
It's a little hard for any of us to know that, given the news blackout that has been posed by the Syrian government. There is, obviously, for our listeners, the divisions within the Syrian army are sectarian, as they are in many of these countries. The officer corps is controlled by these minority Alawites, which are part of the tribal regime mechanism, and majority of the conscripts are Sunni. There have been incidences during the last 4 months where conscripts have defected to or have refused to fire on protesters, which is one of the reasons why Syria has turned to Iran to bring in its collective goon squads of riot police to basically substitute, or as well as to provide logistical support to the commanders who are Alawite.
So, and Iran is not just supplying its thugs in the form of both the Law Enforcement Service, the LED, or the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the IRGC, which are the de facto rulers of Iran. Also the besieged militias. They were the people, they were the sort of strike breakers and thugs who beat up the protesters in the Green Revolution.
Yeah, indeed. In fact, we have information from different intelligence sources that there's at least two battalions, if you can call them battalions, of besiege. This is spelled B-A-S-I-J. These are the civilian-clad thugs that are the riot control operatives that were used by the Khomeini government against the rioters after the elections in in Iran, and they've now brought in these battalions into the major cities in Syria to go after the protesters as well as their families.
Again, I'm speaking with Ambassador Mark Ginsburg, who has an article out in the Huffington Post called Iran's Proxy War in Syria is Shoring Up Assad. So given the clear stake that Iran feels it has in this, and by extension, Hezbollah, since they are a surrogate of Iran, I'm astounded that the West, including the United States, isn't more involved in recognizing that they surely know who the bad guys are in the neighborhood. And why would they then allow the really bad guys to prop up this hideous regime and not in any way want to see it go down?
The Obama administration has been playing a bad version of Syrian two-step diplomatically with the regime, and I fault Secretary Clinton on this. She has consistently sent the wrong message to Assad that he was indispensable and that she was looking for some negotiated settlement while the violence and the escalation of murders continued. Now, after the U.S. Embassy was attacked last week, her rhetoric changed and she declared Assad to be illegitimate, and yet at the same time, the United States has not gone as far as it could to impose sanctions against the oil exports of Syria, on which the government is totally dependent for its foreign currency at this point, in addition to Iranian infusions of support. And secondly, to get the European Union to stop buying oil from Syria. That includes Germany, Poland, the Netherlands, and I believe Italy. Now, how many more body counts must this administration have before it takes the next steps that all of us know it could be taking, and yet for some reason it is not? The best speculation I have is that the administration is completely tied itself up in knots, trying to figure out whether it can do anything to take Assad out of power without appearing to the media as involving itself in another conflict in the Middle East without having any ability to influence events.
Well, to some extent, you know, because Assad and his clan by extension the Iranians blame everything that's happening in Syria on the Israelis and the Americans, it's probably wise not to have any fingerprints. But the very fact that the American ambassador there recently went to Hama and was in the demonstrations, his presence there probably saved thousands of lives. So,
indeed. Robert Ford is a very talented ambassador, and I have enormous respect for him as a career Foreign Service officer. And yet at the same time, he is reporting back to a administration that doesn't quite have its act together on policy towards Syria. And that's the real problem here. I think Americans should be genuinely perplexed on why my friends in the Obama administration are having such a difficult time calling Assad out, given the fact that so many more Syrians, courageous Syrians, have defied the gunfire in the streets of Syria's cities, and yet the best the administration can offer is an occasional trotting out of a statement declaring resentment and anger over these killings.
Well, already, as you probably know, Ambassador Ginsburg, the Australian Foreign Minister, has called on the International Criminal Court to indict the Assads.
Well, of course, and indeed, I recognize that a UN Security Council would probably never agree to that, given Russian and Chinese opposition to doing anything against Assad. But the fact of the matter is that moral persuasion is as important as actual persuasion in the Security Council. I think that most people who look at this objectively would be questioning why the United States is not doing more against the regime. And those of us who have studied Syria and have genuinely asked our friends in the administration, why aren't you doing more? There's more you can do. The best answer we get is that they hope that somehow or other the new reformed transitional authority, which is the opposition, would somehow coalesce around a negotiated settlement with the regime. Well, listen, let's be real here. The Assad regime is not about to give up power to anybody, and we're whistling past the graveyard if we think that somehow or other that's going to change because the United States would like to see something that in Syria that didn't happen in Libya.
And meanwhile, these incredibly courageous Syrians demonstrate, and presumably on Friday again, they will take to the streets, risk their lives, those that are killed, then their families, when they attend their funerals, they're likely to be shot by Maher Assad's thugs and the Iranians now who are helping out. I mean, it's extraordinary, Ambassador Ginsburg, because, for example, right next door, a country that has a lot of influence, Turkey. I understand that Turkish Prime Minister is disgusted with the Assads, and he's cut bait with them.
Absolutely. He visited, this is Davutoğlu, the foreign minister of Turkey. Turkey really made a real effort to reverse its bad relations with Syria when Prime Minister Erdogan's party came to power in Turkey. And the foreign minister visited Assad 19 times. Well, they did everything they could to try to have some influence on Syria. Turkey has enormously expansive influence in the Middle East, and now they're totally disgusted. Well, what again does the Obama administration need but another example of a former friend of Syria, such as Turkey, turning against the regime and the administration still sitting on its hands and keeping its mouth relatively closed about the events in Syria?
Well,
now, by the way, I'm not condoning the idea of the U.S. being involved militarily in Syria.
But there's so many steps that can be taken short of that. That's the part that I'm mystified. And you've pointed out in your article in the Huffington Post, Ambassador Mark Ginsburg, that the Iranians have pumped in $5.6 billion to shore up Syria because the Syrian banks, their depositors, are seeking havens in Beirut and Istanbul. So already there's a capital flight out of Syria. We know that, for example, during the Balkan War, when Milosevic stole the treasury and parked it in Cyprus, there was a lot of efforts. There are a lot of tools in the U.S. toolbox in terms of going after finances. So they did it
part of the problem here is the problem that, of course, the administration reacts on its foreign policy in the Middle East on a 24/7 news cycle. And because there are no bloody photos coming out of Syria, such as the terrible atrocity that was committed in this funeral in Homs the other day, where the security forces killed the mother and son of the protester who was being buried, point blank. And if that had been put or caught on television, I guarantee you there would be a huge outcry in this country among some of the anchors of our media outlets, which would have caused the administration to react. Well, in the absence of these photos, the administration basically feels more or less that it can hide behind what is a losing policy because it doesn't have to step out any further.
But my understanding,
it doesn't make a lot of sense, frankly.
It doesn't make a lot of sense, but my understanding is that looking at the other side of the coin and what is the glue that holds this disgusting regime together in power in that country is the fear of sectarian violence, which is the card that the Assads play all the time. But if you've got this population, and clearly they saw what happened next door in Iraq, they don't want Syria to end up that way. So this would seem to be the time where you target those people and you let them know that you're on their side and that Syria can hold together and can be a so much better place without this family of thugs who think it's their divine right to rule this country.
Listen, it's been conventional wisdom by people who don't know Syria, including people in the Obama administration, that to push Assad aside would create the very sectarian strife that the administration claims they're trying to avoid. And yet, it's really the exact reverse. The longer the regime is able to stay in power, the longer the protesters protest, the more likely the administration is going to trigger sectarian strife because there's growing resentment among the Sunni majority populations at the atrocities that the Alawites are committing against them. So the administration has it completely backwards.
So, but this is also an administration that is doing everything it can to find ways to bring about sanctions against Iran. So,
agreed. And as I said, the irony of it all is that there's as I said, it's been an erratic, inconsistent policy. And when you try to get a straight answer out of the administration on what exactly is it trying to pursue, it sort of pivots left and right without knowing exactly what it is. Its fallback position is, we don't want to do anything to inflame the situation any further that could create more sectarian strife. That's the default position. The default position is from its inception incorrect, given the events that are unfolding now. So the administration is caught holding on to a policy that is actually shopworn and overtaken by events.
But I thought the subtext of our policy in Iran was, and perhaps it's chimeric, but the subtext is that hopefully one of these days the Iranian people are going to rise up against this unpopular Islamo-fascist clique that runs the place, and that all of those people that showed up in the streets that were beaten up by the besieged, they've been described as the embers that are underneath, that are burning beneath the ashes. So that's the only way that Iran's ever going to be free. The people have to do it themselves. So you would think that anything to diminish the influence of the IRGC, and if they're acting in desperation to hold up the Assad's, we should be doing everything we can to thwart them.
Well, I agreed, and I just I keep thinking of words that to describe my feelings on this, and I guess the only way I can summarize the attitude of the Obama administration in Syria is that it's addicted to the devil it knows.
Well, I guess that explains our tardiness with Mubarak in Egypt, but we, finally made the right decision there.
Yes, and as I said, I think part of the problem here also is that the administration is bereft of people who truly know the Arab world and understand the Middle East very well. It's very, very weak along the lines. And not that Syria has been a country that everyone has understood, but it's been part of the same problem that we face. We're sort of used to dealing with the dictatorship. We didn't really spend a lot of time figuring out what the country was all about.
Yeah, and then the Arab Spring caught us by surprise.
Yes.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Ambassador Ginsburg.
Sure. Pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Ambassador Mark Ginsburg, who's a former presidential advisor and United States ambassador to Morocco. He serves as a legislative assistant to Senator Edward Kennedy, special assistant to the Secretary of State, deputy senior advisor to the President for Middle East Policy, and special U.S. coordinator for the Mediterranean Trade, Investment, and Security Affairs. He serves as a special advisor to the Department of Defense Special Operations Command and an advisor to the United States Department of State on outreach initiatives to the Muslim world. He has an article out in the Huffington Post called Iran's Proxy War in Syria is Shoring Up Assad. Let's take a brief station break, and we're back joined by an Israeli general.
Give me the chance.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. I'm now joined by Brigadier General Nehemia Dagan, who served in the Israeli Defense Force from 1985 to 1988. He was the Israeli Defense Force's Chief Education Officer, a position that does not exist in any other armed forces. He's currently in the United States on a tour sponsored by J Street, explaining to American communities the need for a two-state solution. You may learn more about it at jstreet.org. Welcome to Background Briefing, Brigadier General Nehemia Dagan.
Hello.
Obviously, things could not be bleaker in terms of not just peace between the Israelis and Palestinians, but there's not even a peace process.
This is a tragedy concerning Israel, and what I'm talking now is talking about Israel. I'm not talking about the Palestinian. I'm not talking about the humanitarian problem that they have. I really care about my country, and the fact there is no peace process and the fact that nothing is moving is very bad for Israel. And I can explain why. If we keep this situation as it is, meaning forever, we hold these territories forever, in 3 years, in a matter of fact, we are the minority in the area. The Jews are the minority in the area. Now, there are two options to keep the Jewish state. Is to keep the Arabs in this territory second-class citizens. So this is Jewish state. It's not a democracy, and it can be done. It cannot be done. You know, sooner or later we will be forced by others to make it one state for everybody, and this is the end of the Jewish state. The second danger is that they will not tolerate this situation. The Palestinians. And they will start terror. They start terrorize us. Terrorize, and nobody knows how to fight terror. People that say they have a Jewish, Arab state, Palestinian state, it will be another state to fight with us in a war. We know how to fight wars. We don't know how to fight terror. So terror is the next option. And the third thing is that I'm afraid, I'm really scared that the Arabs at some point will decide to do the contrary. They will decide, okay, let's keep the situation as it is. And in 10 years, they are the majority, and it's the end of us either way, and I explained it before. So that's why I believe that we have to move the process as quick as we can, as soon as possible.
Well, in terms of the so-called war on terror, which, of course, is a term from our former president, George W. Bush, my understanding is actually that the Palestinian Authority, that is Abbas's group, actually cooperate with Israel in terms of diminishing and reducing terrorist acts from their territory. Is that not the case?
That's right. This is the case. But they are doing it expecting that it will be another stage. They will not keep it this way forever without any advance. And this is the tragedy. Because if we will not give them any future, a future meaning a future for a Palestinian state, and future meaning negotiations, the Hamas will tell them, you see, you are cooperating with them, and they use you to protect themselves against terror, but giving you nothing. And it and the Hamas will tell them, the only thing that the Israelis understand is power. And what will happen, you can imagine by yourself. You don't need me to explain to you.
Well, I think also you have to factor in, surely, these tectonic movements in the Arab world with the Arab Spring. The younger generation of Palestinians are much more impatient, surely, than the people that Israel's been negotiating with for so long. And in fact, you recall the recent leakage of the so-called Palestinian papers to Al Jazeera. They suggested to the Arab world that the Palestinian leadership was being, totally smoked, to use a slang word, by the Israelis.
No, that's what they say. And we have to avoid this situation, because if you ask me, in the meantime, that's what's happening.
Mm-hmm. So what isn't happening? What isn't happening then, General Dagan? What isn't happening is what? Netanyahu and Barak? I mean, what are they doing?
What's not happening is Netanyahu and Barak declared that they are ready to meet the Palestinians, no matter there is an agreement between the PLO and Hamas or not, no matter what they say, let's sit near the table and start to negotiate. And we will not before we come to a terms, not in everything, but at least about the borders. borders and the security measures. That's all. And then after we agree on the border security measure, we go slice by slice and we solve all the problems because all the problems are solvable. My experience shows that all the problems are solvable once there is a notion of the two sides to solve them.
But what you've just told us is what you think they should do, right? It's not what they are doing.
No, they are not doing it. But you know what? They will do it. At the end of the day, they will do it because if they will not do it, two things will happen. Number one, economic crisis, because look what's happening in Israel today. And people in Israel start to understand that the money that is pouring, the government is pouring into the settlements is relative to nothing. It's unbelievable how much money they pour in this place. And this is coming on account of the Israelis in the Green Lines. That's number one. And number two, a military catastrophe. I mean, another intifada. It's very tragic that we learn only from catastrophes.
And General, again, the tent city that's taking place, the demonstrations that have been taking place in Israel, they clearly are a manifestation of a kind of economic distress that in many ways we have here in the United States, although our people aren't taking to the streets. I take it that the Israeli economy has headed in a direction where there's a greater and greater disparity of wealth between the few at the top and then the rest.
That's right.
And you think that...
But the difference between America and Israel is that in America, it's a big country, people do not know each other. In Israel, people know each other, see each other, serve in the same service in the reserves or in the military. Everything is closed, and people in Israel are asked to give over and beyond what it's not asked in America. Israel to exist still need the individual to give over and beyond. And when the situation is this youngster cannot, are not ending the month with a salary, and they have to give over and beyond, and they see the gape, and they see the people in the other side of the gape, it will lead to something more than just demonstrations.
So, but these young demonstrators, a part of what they're protesting is the how much money goes to the West Bank settlements. Is that's a palpable irritation, is it?
Yes, they understand that they don't have it because it goes to the settlements.
So this is a far cry from the sort of socialist kibbutzim model of the founders, right?
No, yes, we are far away from there, and too far. I don't think that we have to become stay a socialist or to be socialist country.
Right.
But at least we went too far to the free economy, and it's not suitable. You know, we adapt everything that America does, and we are still not in the place that we can adapt everything like this economy of the I don't know how you say it in English, but in Israel it's the pig behavior.
Mm-hmm. I get it.
We cannot survive this way.
Right. No, I think you've put it very clearly. Over the years, General Dagan, I've spoken to a lot of people, including the late Prime Minister Rabin, and also Yehoshaphat Hakabi. Do you remember him, former head of military intelligence?
Hakabi, sure.
Yeah. Well, he was one of the first generals to talk about a two-state solution. It's always struck me as a great irony that people don't seem to understand that the people who have called for a Palestinian state from the very beginning in Israel have been senior military officials.
Yeah, because we understand, we know, because we participated in so many wars, we know that the wars solve nothing. We know that we don't know how to fight terror. We understand, and our life was devoted to the country for, you know, from the beginning, and we don't have kind of a... we think about our political future. This is not us. And what drives Bibi Netanyahu now, I'm sorry to say, but is a political future of the next 18 months. This is his future. And that's what drives him, the coalition, and not what's good for Israel.
Well, but given the coalition politics of Israel, is there anything you can do? I mean, Henry Kissinger once made the remarks that Israel doesn't have a foreign policy, they just have domestic politics.
That's right. You saw Bibi in the Congress. That's what he did there.
Mm-hmm. What can be done? I mean, for a while there, a lot of people thought that Kadima was the answer, and they just kind of fizzled.
I tell you what, that's why we are here. I believe that there are four parties in this to solve this problem. The four parties are Israel, the Palestinians, America, and the European Quartet. These are the four parties. Once two parties decide to sit and to talk, this is the end of the conflict. The two parties can be Israel and the Palestinians. The two parties can be America and Europe to bring us to the table. Because at the end of the day, we have to be in both sides of the table. If you ask me if there is a way that America can bring us to the table, I believe yes, not by sanctions. I am totally opposing sanctions, even to the Palestinian state. Now, there is in the Congress and legislation to stop aid to the Palestinians and the UNRWA. Big mistake, because you are turning the people to be desperate. Desperate people are not good partners for negotiations. Since I know that between 70 and 80% of the Israelis agree that the solution is a two-state solution, and this is the number, 70 to 80, the only thing that they are afraid, and Netanyahu is kind of he puts fire in this fear all the time. This is his policy, to make the Israelis afraid, terrified from this agreement. If the America and the Europeans will come and they will say, listen, we are here to protect the agreement, and it will be a good agreement, so this is the solution. So my suggestion is that America and Europe will find a way. Maybe the way is to send Clinton and the father, Bush, to Israel to be a mediator. Mm-hmm. And to find other ways to push Israel and the Palestinians to sit and talk, no sanctions.
Well, we know, General Dagan, that just recently President Obama was forced to go to the State Department and make a speech about Israel-Palestine because of the arrival of Netanyahu, who was invited to the Congress to speak. And the Congress is not supposed to make foreign policy. The president is. So the president, I think, felt his prerogatives were being attacked and felt he had to get the jump on Netanyahu. And as you know from the way the Congress responded to Netanyahu's speech, there was a great deal of support for him. But most people attribute that to the effectiveness of AIPAC. And Mike, and I know that you're working with J Street, which is an alternative to AIPAC. And I guess the argument could be made, surely, that one of the reasons why the United States has not been an active and honest broker is because you can make the case that AIPAC has been so successful that it's actually a victim of its own success. In other words,
first of all, the majority of the Jews in America are not supporting the policy of AIPAC. That's number one.
Right.
Number two, what AIPAC says to them is that we support any governmental decision whatsoever. That's what AIPAC said. We are not questioning what the government is doing. And I gave them an example, the people that I talk. I said, listen, my daughter is getting divorced. And she doesn't have a fuse at all. She is immediately exploding. And I'm trying to tell her, you are doing wrong here and wrong there. And she said to me, Father, your only role is to support me. That's what AIPAC says. My answer to her was, and if you are going standing now on the wall and on the roof and want to jump, I will support you. And this is the issue. AIPAC support everything, but if you analyze what they're supporting stand still, and this is the end of Israel. This is the problem. I am afraid that in the AIPAC there are some people that number one, they think that we have to stay and to have the great Israel. People, I don't know if from AIPAC, but people that are influential to AIPAC. And that's my fear. And the others support the notion that, you know what, to establish a state takes more than 60 years. So maybe we'll be in a war for 100 years with the Palestinians. And at the end of the day, we will do at the end of the day. And when you come to them to this question, at the end of the day, so they have no answer. They have no answer. They just support. I believe that the liberal Jews in America that see the situation as it is, as many, many generals see it, they have to find a way to support their government, to support Obama, to support the notion of bringing us, the two parties, to the negotiation table.
Well, I think that the point I was trying to make, General Dagan, is that by being having such influence in Congress, the AIPAC have become victims of their own success, in as much as the Americans have never gotten off the dime. They've never been the honest broker. There's no incentive for America to act, and it's like an echo chamber, you know. And
that's right.
nothing's been achieved. So one would hope that the expression I've heard in relation to the relationship is that it's an assisted suicide pact.
I think so.
Yeah. Just in closing, then, give us a sense of what liberal Jews who are listening to us, and even conservative American Jews who are listening to us, what can they do and what should they do?
They have to understand that the standstill as it is today is bringing Israel to a disaster. They have to understand that without the Palestinian state, the meaning is that the majority of the population between the Jordan and the sea will be Arab. They have to understand that the majority of the Palestinians between the sea and the Jordan is the end of the Jewish state. The only way you can keep it Jewish is by not being democracy, by being South Africa. I believe that every American resists this option. So the only way is to try to convince the government of Israel. And by the way, you know that Ron Lauder, that he is a great supporter of Bibi Netanyahu, say to him, I don't know if you heard about it, you must go and start negotiating with the Palestinians, no matter what your personal future, political future is. Did you hear about it?
No, I didn't, no.
Oh, yeah, Ron Lauder, say
wow.
to him. And he is a great supporter of it.
Sure.
And I want to tell the American Jews that the right wing in America, people like Sheldon Adelson, they are trying to influence the Israeli politics. Sheldon Adelson, he has a newspaper in Israel that supports Bibi Netanyahu. It's a free. And it's terrible that he is direct involvement in Israeli politics. At least I expect from the liberal Jews in America to express their opinion, to support their leaders in the Congress.
Well, I thank you for joining us. It's been a very interesting conversation, General Dagan.
Thank you very much.
I've been speaking with Brigadier General Nehemiah Dagan, who served in the Israeli Defense Force from 1985 to 1988. He was the Israeli Defense Force's chief education officer, a position that does not exist in any other armed forces. He is currently in the United States on a tour sponsored by J Street, explaining to American communities the need for a two-state solution. You may learn more at jstreet.org. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the economic hostage crisis on Capitol Hill. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. I'm now joined by Thomas Ferguson, who's a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He's a member of the advisory board for George Soros' Institute for New Economic Thinking and a contributing editor to The Nation. He is the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Ferguson.
Hi there.
We're talking under these ridiculous circumstances where the current economic hostage crisis in Washington, D.C. is brought on by those who created the deficit, and yet they expect all of us, except for the wealthiest of Americans, to pay down all the costs, which will end up killing economic recovery. So how did we get into this mess?
Where does one start, you know? I mean, I think the best way to start, actually, one mentions the Bush tax cuts, which did vastly increase the deficit. But in truth, the giant deficits come from the Great Recession and the bank bailouts. I mean, the bank bailouts directly are expensive, but in truth, it's the giant fall off in national income that has so swelled deficits here. We've been over this terrain many times, Ian, and the truth is they should be running deficits now because the unemployment rate is so high. Trying to close these things as the Republicans are trying to do, like with big cuts next year, is quite insane and certainly is going to put, if they actually do this, which I think they will not, you know, it's going to put a lot more people out of work. Then, of course, the next stage in getting there is surely Obama's decisions to sort of essentially reverse his positions on the tax cuts. That is to say, he'd opposed extending them for the wealthy. Then he decided to do that. I mean, he said he wasn't going to do that past 2012, but they're already talking about some extension of that. And it created a lot of doubt in a lot of people's mind, myself included, as to whether, in fact, he wouldn't, in fact, cave again and just never go after them. I mean, that type of stuff added to sort of some anxieties about the deficit. This is not, as I say, something we should really be worrying about. But we got here, and then we get, finally, essentially the Republicans concentrating on two things, not just one thing. Yes, they want to cut the deficit. The other thing they're trying to do in most of these plans is generally give yet more tax cuts to the wealthy. I mean, that's built in even to the famous Ryan budget that is supposed to eventually cut, what's it, $4 trillion in spending over. They forget to mention it gives, you know, almost that sum actually in tax cuts out too, mostly to upper income groups. So you have the Republicans pushing for, in effect, more tax cuts for the rich and still giant cuts in spending. And then you have basically a very weak response by the Obama administration. Now, in figuring out how we got there, the next step is probably the Obama administration's response, which, you know, they did one thing at the start that has been disastrous and has colored every aspect of American politics, which is they asked for a stimulus which was about half as big as it should have been, given the depth of the recession. And that has effectively discredited the idea. The failure of that to revive the economy, even though for sure it kept a lot of people employed. I mean, the number, for instance, of folks who would have lost jobs, you can just see that real easily. You just look at, say, the sort of the way state and local numbers are now dropping now that that stimulus is going off, state and local employment I'm talking about. They discredited the whole idea of activist government. And that plays powerfully in the background on all of this because there's nothing worse than failing spectacularly and in public, and they failed. And then, of course, they have failed to offer any counterarguments against sort of major budget cuts. You know, it baffles and enrages a lot of people. I don't mind saying it enrages me, too. I mean, this has become crazy. For Obama to sort of, I mean, in particular, the way he kept moving to sort of talk closer and closer, endorsing, you know, the Gang of Six.
Well, he had his deficit commission before then.
Yes, he
which
had,
was
thank
paid
you.
For in, by Pete Peterson.
Well, in part.
He paid for
they
the salaries.
Paid for some of the staff. I
right,
think.
Exactly. But I'm still, let's face it, that guy's a deficit zealot. I mean,
it's hard to understand, and particularly the thing that is most discouraging is the way they picked up Social Security, because Social Security's contribution to the deficit is essentially nothing. Even their own apologists, like Peter Orszag, who was, you know, the former head of the Office of Management and Budget, who then fled to Citigroup there, I mean, he confessed in his little essay in the New York Times on that Social Security wasn't a major contributor to the deficit at all. It might add, he thought, 1% of debt to GDP at the end of 2050. And the issue where you get out to here is these long projections, which essentially show he's basing it, just like I am, on the trustees' reports, although I think he probably wrote before the latest one came out, and I'm taking account of that latest. You know, that trust fund is in good shape through 2036, and if it fails at that point, they might have, if their growth projections were dead on target, which they won't be, they might then have a small shortfall. they'd still be making 70% or more of the revenue they need to pay out. So bankruptcy talk's crazy, but that's a very long time away. And there's just no reason to get that excited. I mean, listening to all these guys who could not see effectively the financial crisis coming in 2008 to sort of suddenly get nervous about a problem in 2036, this is really straining after gnats, or to use, what was it, Alan Campbell's thing where he was talking about he was going to spear all the whales. Social Security's a minnow. It just doesn't belong in any deficit discussion at all, no matter how many folks from the right tell you differently. You know, for Obama to embrace that nonsense is, I think, really disgraceful. And there is just no reason Social Security, you know, cuts in the form of cost of living increase formulas, they just shouldn't be on the table, particularly given the way ordinary Americans have had to pay the bill for the bank bailout and then watch their mortgages decline. It's really disgraceful. The Medicare story, we've been over this a fair amount too. They need to contain the growth of medical costs. There's no doubt about that, but we also know roughly what you got to do it, which is you need to do things like let the government use its bargaining power to bargain down the cost of pharmaceuticals.
Sure, and it's all happening in the private sector, by the way.
What's that?
I mean, the growth in medical costs is largely in the private sector.
Of course. Not with
Medicare. So that's another phony argument. Let me make a suggestion here. I know you had a piece in the Financial Times, Thomas Ferguson, about big money politics and how much the leaderships and the parties control the money. It looks like Bain is going to exact some punishment on some of these Tea Party people. We do this interview before we go to air. At this point, the vote has been delayed because Boehner can't pull the votes together.
But I think he'll finally get them together.
Sure. Well, by the time we go to air, he probably will have.
But it is my guess. Yeah, all right. Well, let's talk.
But what I want to do now is I want to play a clip of Senator McCain, just to give you an idea of how some people in the Republican Party view these Tea Party insurgents. Let's go to the clip.
The idea seems to be that if the House GOP refuses to raise the debt ceiling, a default crisis or gradual government shutdown will ensue, and the public will turn en masse against Barack Obama. Republican House that failed to raise the debt ceiling would somehow escape all the blame. Then Democrats would have no choice but to pass a balanced budget amendment and reform entitlements, and the Tea Party hobbits could return to Middle Earth having defeated Mordor. This is the kind of crack political thinking that turned Sharon Angle and Christine O'Donnell into GOP Senate nominees.
Now, that was a clip of John McCain quoting from a Wall Street Journal editorial to give you an idea of some of the feelings within the Republican Party from its traditional Republicans about how they feel about these Tea Party insurgents. Again, I'm joined by Thomas Ferguson, professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. Do you think that there will be a reckoning here? Do you think the American people have seen that these people that swept in 2010, let me ask you this, in 2012, will the Democrats show up to vote to get rid of more of these people?
Well, I think the Democrats showing up to vote is very much an open question. One of the things that destroyed the Democrats' chances in the Senate race in Massachusetts, which was the first fire alarm bell to ring in the night back when in January 2010, when Scott Brown upset the Democratic favorite there, was the stupendous fall off in Democratic towns there. You know, the fall off in voter turnout in 2010 from 2008 is the second largest in American history. That is to say, the decline in turnout. I mean, it normally falls off for an off-year elections, but that decline was huge. You know, I must say that I think the Obama administration is now seriously risking its own base. I mean, a lot of people are making jokes about, well, they're really, you know, liberal Republicans or something. It's not funny anymore. That's a real problem. But Ian, let me, if I could, come back to this question of the role of party finance in getting us to here, if I could. I
mean, sure.
We're in this sort of insane position. You know, it's a piece I did in the Financial Times, was essentially picked up on this simple point, which is since about the 1990s, both major parties have, in effect, started posting prices for committee chairs and leadership positions. That is to say, if you are a representative or a senator, you have to agree to contribute a certain amount of money to the party, and you have to raise more money. And typically you add in contributions of your own to your colleagues there. Now, the thing is that these contributions go into the national party committees. That's typically the national senatorial or the congressional campaign committees, House and Senate, respectively. Those are under the control of the leadership. So what you've done in the last 20 years is create this kind of legislative leviathan where you give the leadership vastly more resources. Now, if you're an entrenched incumbent, you can still afford to ignore them sometimes. But if you are running in an open seat election, meaning there's no incumbent, or you're under, you got a serious challenger, which happens to everybody at least once, and then you really need those resources. And the national parties provide a lot of other stuff with that cash, notably consulting services, polling, and they also, I mean, for that matter, it's not legal to solicit. You can't dial for dollars out of your office, so you have to go somewhere near the Capitol and do it. And they go over there in the national party offices in those campaign committees often to do it. And that tends to put the leadership in a much stronger position relative to individual members of Congress than they were. Now, the Republicans do have an interesting fillip on this in that they've got some PACs that also want to push the party to the right. That is to say, they will actually run candidates against incumbent Republicans, which is very unusual. So you get a kind of double movement there where you have the leadership with much stronger authority over individuals, but everybody, including the leadership, getting pushed a bit to the right by some of these groups like the so-called Club for Growth and things like that. And this is really an important background to what's happening here, because you can see very plainly the way the party, this frantic effort on not a few people crossing party lines to do something in the national interest, but to move as a kind of like a giant crab. Everybody moves at once in this kind of lockstep. You know, it's a real change in legislative behavior, and what's driving it is money.
And it's driving America off the cliff.
Ian, you know, somebody said to me the other day, you know, I'm going to vote for Mickey Mouse. Disney's profitable. Everybody's happy in there. That's probably the best deal now. My joke for ages has been, look, if you want a happy ending, see a Disney movie. Don't watch politics. Then Tim Burton went to work for Disney, and I began to get nervous about that. But hey, yeah, it's a problem.
Just the notion that the economy of this country is being held hostage by people who like petulant teenagers, they want 100% of everything, and they're willing to take the whole house down. It's already affected markets. It's already affected confidence around the world. Here we are trying to sell T-bills every day. We have to sell billions of dollars of T-bills, and the United States government now is advertising to the world, don't buy our T-bills. I mean, this is an insane,
very odd behavior. It is, I think, extremely short-sighted.
Well, what rationality is left in the discourse? Do you really think that people are going to figure this one out, that these people really are irresponsible as well as being amazingly ignorant?
Look, I have to tell you, here you got to sort of be a little nervous, because a lot of folks, I think, you can see plainly, I think in the last three elections, many people just followed an in-out, out-in model. 2006, 8, 10, somebody said to me, gee, you know, in 2008 we threw out the Republicans, in 2010 we threw out the Democrats. Who do we throw out in 2012? When you look across history at this, especially in the Depression, which, you know, even though we're not at Depression, with the Great Recession is really a stupendous and calamitous event. What you find is after three or four years of this, the swamp creatures come out and it begins to get really kind of rancid. And you can see, you know, there are all these groups suddenly forming with new, talking third parties and things like that, some of them very well financed. Now, I mean, there was one announced in Thomas Friedman's column last Sunday in the New York Times. They're a very well-financed group. The political system's breaking up, because what's actually happening is the population detests both major parties and their political leaders. They don't like either of them. And that opens up the situation in a way that has not been open in our lifetime. So I'm not sure this is a happy ending. I think it will be a bumpy ride.
I thank you for joining us here today, Thomas Ferguson.
Thanks. Always a pleasure, Ian. Bye-bye.
Again, I've been speaking with Thomas Ferguson, professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. He's a member of the advisory board for George Soros' Institute for New Economic Thinking and a contributing editor for The Nation. He is the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began with Ambassador Mark Ginsburg, who has a piece in the Huffington Post about how Iran's Revolutionary Guards are propping up the Assad regime in Syria. And we had a long discussion about why it is that the United States opposes the Revolutionary Guard regime in Iran, who effectively run the place. They have sanctions against them. We saw what they did to their own people during the Green Revolution. Apparently, they honed their skills and now applying that to prop up the Syrian regime. And he really was deeply critical, even though he's close to the White House and Hillary Clinton and company, he was deeply critical of their essentially feckless policy towards Syria. In effect, they're in complicity with the media blackout, because as long as there aren't any pictures on television of the kind of murders that are going on, where families are being shot down at point-blank range at funerals, where their sons and daughters have been murdered by the regime, then the regime comes on and shoots them in while they're having funerals. If that kind of those kind of pictures were on television, the White House would be forced to respond. So they're basically going along with the news blackout, which is pretty shameful given the fact that they intervened in Libya, where obviously things were pretty flagrant. But there seems to be a lot more at stake in Syria, and at least the Iranians seem to understand that. Then we talked with Israeli Air Force veteran Brigadier General Nahima Dagan, who's over here touring the country with J Street, which is the dovish alternative to AIPAC. He really ripped into AIPAC and how they have a kind of suicide pact with the Netanyahu Israeli government, preventing the United States from forcing Israel to make peace. And he feels if they don't make peace, the two-state solution is their only hope, and it is fading rather fast. And the alternative to become a South Africa is completely unpalatable, and that people have got to force the American government and American Jews, particularly the liberal American Jews, have to step up here and force Obama to do the right thing and not to be intimidated and cowed by AIPAC. And then finally, I spoke with the economist and political scientist Thomas Ferguson about this insanity on Capitol Hill. He has a piece in the Financial Times where he says, in effect, that what's happened to the Congress is that the congressional leaders control all this money, because it's all about money. And this money is being used as a kind of weapon to control the discipline. That's why the Republicans move in one block, because it's all about the money that they have that they dole out. And of course, that means that Speaker Boehner will be able to punish some of these Tea Party wackos. We played the clip of John McCain criticizing them as well. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. You can hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. And I'll be back with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time one night in America.